I'll never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the, sixth Skanon podcast. Yes, week 7 in terms of the cinema. So, yeah, it is 6th Skanon podcast. So, today, I'm back again. Hello. I'm joined by Darren.
Hello.
And Ronan.
Hello.
And Alex.
Hello.
Excellent. Everyone's here. We have a quorum.
And very very verbose as well.
I like that you all went for a different greeting there. Mm. So we start off, as per usual, with what we've been watching lately. So we start with Darren.
Well, I figured that with last week seeing the release of the first primarily black Marvel Studios film, I go back. And also the release of a Guillermo del Toro romance as well. I go back and I look at the last time those two overlapped. So I watched the first two Blade films, which were great fun. They really, really are. I'm actually very fond of both of them. They hold up remarkably well in terms of, there are many things about the first two Blade films that the ensuing comic book boom could learn a lot from. In that you can see a lot of the DNA that's there. For example, Stephen Dorff's like pouty, shirtless man-child raging at his parents is basically the template for every successful comic book villain who isn't Heath Ledger's Joker. But you also have a sense of like the choreography and stunt work that's largely missing from modern productions. You can kind of see in Blade 2 CGI coming in and getting a bit sort of like, you know, uncanny valley-y, but like stuff like long takes and stuff like action beats and stuff like practical stunts done by Snipes, who is a black belt himself. And even just things like it not being beholden to what you expect of what comic book fans expect in terms of fidelity, in terms of radically reinventing the character, but also in terms of self-seriousness, in terms of it's a movie about a man who wears a leather trench coat no matter what the weather in Los Angeles, wears sunglasses indoors, and, you know, kills vampires, but takes itself entirely seriously, or relatively seriously in those terms. And it holds up very, very well. I actually slightly prefer the first one to the second one, although Del Toro's second one is interesting because it's literally a comic book movie, in that it opens with a voiceover from the lead character introducing himself, explaining what it is. There's a moment where he freezes the camera so that it can zoom over an action sequence in the style of the eye moving over a comic book page, and it's got this sort of outlandish, like, bright neon red and dark blacks. I also watched Hotel Rwanda at the weekend for a completely different change of pace, which is, yeah.
This was to tie Africa into the conversation as well.
No, not at all. Nothing to do with that. I had to be putting it off for a while and needed to watch it, but it was, a very effective movie about a harrowing piece of history. Rewatching again, it's remarkable how well Terry George balances tone within it. In particular because The Promise, which was the Armenian genocide film that he did last year or the year before, struggled very much with tone in that it was a genocide movie that was also trying to be a historical epic in the style of Lawrence of Arabia. It was this timeless love story and genocide, which didn't really mix very well in terms of storytelling.
Yeah, but that was very much of its maker, you know.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, while Terry George was the director, it was financed, by an Armenian businessman who needed to tell this story,
which
was, you know, so basically it didn't matter if the film ever made money or not, he didn't care as long as
it got made.
Hotel
Rwanda is a much, much better film, and part of that is because George uses the conventions of, say, the horror movie, for example, in terms of building tension very well in the first act. There's a wonderful, well, not wonderful, but a very effective sense of mounting dread that permeates the film, obviously, and it's very careful in what it shows, which is remarkable and very effective for that, I would contend. But yeah, so that was my week in film.
Nice to see you. Northern Irish director, so tangentially, I guess.
An Irish connection in there. Yes. Well, I mean, yeah, it's telling that, like, his work has, you know, he wrote In the Name of the Father and stuff like that, but his work is still in some ways perhaps rooted in Northern Ireland. He's shown a lot of interest in ethnic strife all over the world.
Yeah, and the Troubles and that sort of situation.
And I wonder if that sort of tied into his choices to do, you know, The Promise and to do Hotel Rwanda, which are also stories about ethnic strife as well.
Wrong?
The Promise was the Armenian one, was it?
The Armenian one with Oscar Isaac and Christian
Bale. I didn't hear much about that. Was that good? Or?
No.
Okay. It was bad, was it?
It was
not that the genocide wasn't bad. I mean, the film.
Yeah, to be clear. Yeah, divorcing the quality of the film from its relative importance. Yeah, the Promise was not a good movie.
Okay. And for Turkish listeners, the alleged genocide.
Well, you know, because it was subject to vote brigading on like the IMDb and stuff, and various other forums to drag it down.
Aren't Turkish users quite active
on IMDb? And they hate everything. The bottom 100 films listed on IMDb is surprisingly dominated by Turkish films. Which is great, because I do a podcast where I occasionally discuss them and have no context for Turkish culture. It's like, yes, this guy was involved in a controversy which may or may not account for this movie placing on the list. I have no frame of reference.
That's so strange.
It is. They voted very enthusiastically against The Promise. But hey, I mean, we'll be talking about some other vote brigading later, possibly.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
On topic this week, I watched Fruitvale Station. Which I hadn't seen before. Big fan of Coogler, based on Creed, at least. And this is a really, really good showcase of his ability early on. Same for Michael B. Jordan. It's a really great performance, and the entire film hangs on him and the way he works with Coogler. I wasn't entirely enamored of it. I think it kind of suffers from that real life tragedy basis where it inevitably builds toward the story that everybody knows. And as such, you know, in a way, a similarity I saw was with something like United 93, where, you know what it's building up towards, and everything that heads toward that almost
feels mechanical.
Yeah, it feels like part of a process. And I don't know that the film entirely overcomes that, but it really is a great showcase of talent for both of them. And you know, Coogler is just going from strength.
Oh yeah, he's what, 32 years old?
Yeah,
and he's done these three films.
His career is extraordinary.
Oh yeah, and he's done it without compromising in a major way. And that,
yeah,
his two studio films are like
his
distinctive.
Films.
Yeah. I mean, he's only done one film that's not a studio film, but they feel distinct from the bulk of other films that you would imagine. Like, Creed is a lot better than it should be by any right. Black Panther is a lot better than it should be by any right.
Yeah, and I can't speak to Black Panther, but I imagine it's probably a similar situation to Creed, whereby it hijacks a well-established formula and finds a way to
doesn't
do
it as effectively,
not necessarily new with it, but very different,
ambitious.
Absolutely.
Black Panther will come up later.
Yes.
And then, less relevant to anything else this week, but one of my favourite sentences to say is, I saw the new Nick Cage movie.
Oh, Mom and Dad.
Mom and Dad, which was the AFI Mystery Matinee this month.
Oh my god.
Wow!
Yeah.
Oh,
I had no idea.
Packed out crowd, and they do the thing where they show sort of related trailers that may help you to kind of guess, and they had The Stepfather, and I can't remember what else. But you do that thing where the producers come up and you go, who could this be? What film could this be? And then it dawned.
Oh, they don't have to show you the IFCO or even beforehand.
No, that's
pretty fantastic.
So you gradually see the credits, and there'll be whispers through the audience as people figure it out. But once I figured it out anyway, I was thrilled. That's exactly what I was in the mood for on a Sunday morning, Nick Cage. And it's a hell of a lot of fun. It's by Brian Taylor. Of Neville Dean Taylor fame, of course, and it's about as nuts as you'd expect. And it's a really good showcase for Cage, in that I think he's got to the point where I worry sometimes that we're not going to see a great Cage performance again. He's just gotten into another plane of existence, almost.
He's
all off
he's
by
lost,
himself.
Yes.
But if you frame a movie about him in the right way, you can get something great out of that. And it's not a great film by any means, but it's bonkers. It's really bonkers. The basic concept is that all of the parents in America suddenly turn around for reasons that Taylor isn't terribly interested in. He just wants to get to the action. They turn around and they just decide to kill their kids. So every parent in America tries to murder their children. Nick Cage and Selma Blair have two kids and spend the film trying to kill them.
That sounds like a bad age difference, though. Nick Cage.
Yeah, that's... they don't get a lot of screen time together, actually, but it is absolutely tremendous fun. It's got the whole Taylor aesthetic of, you know, shots are rarely more than about half a second long.
The Michael Bay effect.
I always love this.
Yeah, but done in like a really effectively kinetic.
Early Bay.
I mean, he's a music video director, so he knows when he's at
Yeah.
I always love the story about I think it was Neville Dean Taylor before they sort of split up, but. They in one of the Crank movies were able to do these incredible shots where they sort of lined up the shot as steady as possible. It was nearly steady cam, but it seemed to be like without any tracks, and they could go around. So this film studio said, oh, we need that on this film, can you, like, we'll license the technology or however you do this. And he said, yeah, sure. And he showed up on the set just in rollerblades and said, oh no, I just have a really, really steady grip, and he holds the camera and rollerblades around. And the studio, having paid probably an astronomical amount for this technology, we were like, well...
At least they got a tailor-made approach.
Oh, that's bad, Darren.
Hey! You just got a roller with it.
Hey!
Somebody say something so I don't have to keep doing this.
Do you have any more films? So I watched two. The first one I watched was a fairly old film from 2001 called One Man Up, or Le Uomo in Qui in Italian. But it was the sort of debut feature of Paolo Sorrentino, the guy who did The Great Beauty and a few others. I picked up the collection in the IFI, actually, and this was sort of like included as the very first one. So I watched it. It's good. It's not like always with these kind of directors, you know, when you go back and you sort of start watching their early stuff, you can see the things that make them brilliant and make them interesting. It's just not exactly kind of lined up and not as coherent yet.
Yeah.
So there's like a lot of jarring tone shifts and a lot of use of music that's nearly great, but when it's not great, it's like, oh boy, what's going on? It's a very strange story. Someone described it to me as like, oh, it's about two brothers. But then when you watch the film, it's actually not. It's about two men with the exact same name living in an Italian town. And one of them's a pop star and one of them's a football player. And the idea is the football player gets injured and sort of has this crisis. The pop star gets involved in like a sex scandal and has this crisis. And it sort of just follows the two of them. And they don't really interact, but they're sort of like similar themes in both of their lives, that kind of thing. It was definitely interesting. And if you're a fan of Sorrentino, like I am, I would definitely recommend checking it out. But as I said, it's just not totally coherent with some of its ideas and things like that. But interesting, nonetheless. And Tony Servillo's in it, who's in his later films and that kind of thing. Excuse me. The other film I watched was called Final Portrait, which came out last summer or recently enough to, I don't think, much attention. It's a film about Alberto Giacometti. It stars Armie Hammer and Jeffrey Rush. And obviously everyone's sort of got a lot more time for Armie Hammer these days after Call Me By Your Name. Mm-hmm. So it's, it was up on Netflix and gave it a look. It's sort of about, as I say, this Giacometti guy who's sort of a sculptor but did painting in the latter stage of his life. And Jeffrey Rush plays him, and he does it extraordinarily well. Like, he completely inhabits the role. He's sort of very funny, and then, you know, at other times just a complete, like someone you completely hate, and completely disappears into the role in that sort of Jeffrey Rush way. Armie Hammer is good. It's just he doesn't have as much to work with. It's sort of like one of those things where he's, you know, obviously Jeffrey Rush is completely in the role, and Armie Hammer is playing a sort of straight, tall, pretty guy who...
The Armie Hammer role.
Yes, who Giacometti paints the portrait of. And it's you know, Armie Hammer probably has a harder job in some ways because he's having to like act against this. But interestingly, it was directed by Stanley Tucci. I didn't realize until the final credits. And it's directed quite well by Stanley Tucci.
Stanley Tucci is a really interesting director. He's made some really great films. I'm a huge fan of Big Night.
Yeah, absolutely. This one, it's worth watching for Jeffrey Rush's performance, really, alone. It sort of does that thing where it tries to give you insight into this particularly interesting artist by focusing on a very particular time in this guy's life. And it's interesting because he'd probably be known more for being a sculptor than being for a portrait artist. But in order to like give the audience a surrogate and tell him a bit, can I have to have this interplay with this? And it's interesting because there's a lot of scenes in the film where Jeffrey Rush is sort of raging against never being able to truly capture someone in a medium like a portrait, while at the same time you're watching a film that doesn't really capture it and sort of is, you know, a little bit shallow and it comes to... So I don't know how much of that was Stanley Tucci sort of getting ahead of the critics or sort of head nodding and sort of being like, you know... But it's interesting. It was shot in Paris, so it's quite beautiful, although it's very monochromatic because his paintings were very monochromatic. So they were doing something there.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite short is the only other thing. I know it sounds bad, but if you're looking for
an interesting
little Euro film about a very interesting personality and good performances all around, I'd recommend it.
Mine are slightly more mainstream in that I've recently talked to the two young fellas from The Young Offenders, so I rewatched The Young Offenders.
The Young Offenders is great.
And
fantastic.
It's still hilarious and funny. I mean, it is. My wife hadn't seen it, and so she watched it for the first time, and it was absolutely hilarious. It's warm and funny, and very much of its place. It's very much a Cork story, and it wouldn't work anywhere else. If you tried to place those two young fellas in Dublin, you'd want to kill them. You'd want to slap them. But because of the sing-song voice and that, the whole way of being.
Well, the sense of the Western wilderness and the Monster Republic being its own nation unto itself.
The cute horrorism of it and stuff. Yeah. And the going down into West Cork, you know, because it's beautiful in West Cork.
Yeah.
So there you have that lovely, it's got a road trip feel to it while never leaving the county.
Yeah, well, it even has a map as well, yeah.
It's certainly not on that scale in terms of distribution that we just haven't seen. You know, Cork hasn't got that kind of exposure in a long, long time. And I was really impressed. I recently saw an interview with them. I didn't realise they were, you know, they had Dublin accents. So their Cork accents are incredibly good.
Yeah.
Well, it's hard to do that when you're from outside Cork and to make it sound really genuine.
Their natural accents are not as they're far more well spoken than the two. But yeah, it's funny when talking to them, they do lapse into character accent, which is curious, you know. But no, they're not. At least Chris Wally is definitely from Cork because he worked. He worked in Manpoint in the cinema while the cinema was showing. Oh no, he was working in the shop center while the cinema was showing The Young Offender. He was working in Sweet Shop.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. So.
And now he's on the BBC.
Channel 4, isn't it? That has the
it's BBC Three. So BBC Three is their online platform, a sort of online only channel, and as a result, it has source content from here quite a bit. It got like Can Cope Won't Cope as well, and some of the other comedy TV series. And what they've been doing is, with The Young Offenders, they're the primary commissioning body for it, and their RTE are supplying the equipment I'm doing and stuff so far, so that can be done. So it's not, it is RTE, it's RTE is showing it, BBC Three show it first because they're the ones that are actually
paying,
you know,
for it.
I'm surprised
Netflix aren't involved, because Netflix was the distribution model for The Young Offenders. It obviously was in cinemas, but like it seemed to explode when it hit Netflix, when everyone was just like, check this out.
Well, and now Cardboard Gangsters is on Netflix as well, so a lot of the smaller Irish films, or the more successful Irish films, are going to Netflix as the next port of call after their digital and domestic, or after their domestic distribution. Well, the curious one, Jason, who is in Abstensia currently in the Netherlands, he spotted that on US Netflix, The Breadwinner is there. The Breadwinner, of course, is out tomorrow.
And it's premiering at
ADIF tomorrow, and is not out in Ireland and the UK until May 25th.
So listeners, if you are overseas in America, you can watch it along with us.
That's an
interesting choice. You were saying it's distributed by G-Kids, so I believe
G-Kids
handle, like, Japanese animation primarily, right?
Yeah, and so they've handled the last couple of
the cartoons along.
Yeah, and Studio Ghibli
ones.
Well, Disney have a Studio Ghibli connection there as well. G-Kids do other... some of the other Japanese animation ones. And they've built up a fairly strong reputation in terms of their marketing distribution of animation that isn't studio driven in the US, and so they have a good cachet. Over here it's Studio Canal. They picked it up for distribution the same as they did with Song of the Sea, and they're following the Song of the Sea playbook in that they're releasing it about 7 months after they really should.
Didn't Song of the Sea not do particularly well?
It didn't. No,
so
it's true.
Changing the play. Anyway, never mind.
Yeah, no, you would think it was not. Anyway, the other film I watched is Doctor Strange.
I like Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
Mostly Mads Mikkelsen.
It's grand.
Yeah,
it's grand. It was part of my prep for watching Black Panther. I just went back and watched two Marvel films, and one of them was Doctor Strange. So yeah, it was like, it was the one that Sinead couldn't remember.
The Scott Derrickson one.
Yeah,
I actually don't mind Derrickson. Apart from what was Deliver Us from Evil, which is the home video Exorcist Lion film, which is nowhere near as fun as that description makes it sound.
Exorcist Lion.
Yeah, okay, well, it's the one, it's a cop movie, but it's also an exorcist movie, and there's a scene at the zoo, and somehow it's not an enjoyable film.
It's not exciting.
No, somehow it's just dull. Is that a Gerard Butler film? It sounds like a Gerard Butler film.
Oh, I can't remember watching that.
You can't remember, or you didn't?
No, I did. I just can't remember watching it. I know that I've watched it.
Oh, it's
I
Eric Bana. That's who
it is.
I'm a little disappointed. Olivia Munn, Edgar Ramirez, and Joe McHale, and Sean Harris.
Oh, yeah. Sean Harris on Killing Duty.
Mick Santino.
Yeah,
not a good film. But Derrickson in general, he did Insidious, he did Sinister and stuff like that, right? So he's...
Sean Harrison can be a good villain. He's a good villain in the last Mission Impossible.
No, I was going to say.
Yeah.
He's very good in that.
I think he's in the new one as well.
He is. He appears in the trailer as well.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Continuity. Yeah. They also got the same director back.
For the first time in six films, it's the same director back. And wouldn't you know it, it's Tom Cruise's best friend.
Yeah. Who would have thought that's the only thing it takes to be the first director to direct two Mission Impossible?
I'm glad they're bringing back some continuity. There was one in the, I think it was Ghost Protocol, where they were clearly meant to meet with someone from the first film, and then it wasn't. They were meant to meet with Max from the first film, like even in the hood, and they were setting it up, and it was clear they had this like cameo ready for
Vanessa
Redgrave, and then she just decided not to. So he just meets with some other random dude, and you're like, whoa, come on.
I just learned my technique from Max. She publishes a how-do guide, a wiki-how guide. But no, I don't mind. I actually don't mind there being no continuity between Mission Impossible films, because I feel like we've like franchise blockbusters are
wife, like, four movies ago. There's been no mention. Well,
okay, there have only been two.
She's in the new one.
Oh,
yeah. She also appears in the trailer. I recommend watching the Mission Impossible Fallout trailer.
All this franchise building and all this shared universe stuff. I'm quite happy to have a movie franchise where it's just like Tom Cruise blows some stuff up.
Yeah. What more do you need to know?
Yeah, that's it.
It's the only one Paramount have left. They need this.
Bumblebee, thank you very much.
Oh yeah, the Transformers set.
Yeah. So their entire
it's
lineup,
the only one they have left.
Their entire lineup is financial futures depending on the performance of Bumblebee and Mission Impossible 6.
Yeah, Mission Impossible Fallout. So yeah, hopefully.
Is that a poster with the mustache real?
No.
Okay, because that would seem like that would seem like genuine trolling.
Yeah. No, the only poster so far has been black and gray.
Oh, okay.
Kind of silhouette type job.
Right. Damn it. I wanted Tom Cruise hand gliding off a mustache.
On to the news. So ADIF have decided that to add another film to the roster. So
And another star.
Yes. So Nicola Coster-Waller is here for Three Things. So that's
one film. Three things.
Yes. Three Things is the name of the film.
He may be here for Three Things. Yeah. A film, a drink, dinner, you know.
Yeah, he's really hoping to take in Mary Magdalene while he's over.
But it's so he stars in it. Jens Dahl is the director of it, and it's a Danish production, so it's it's subtitled. It's about a guy, a bank robber who demands three things before he enters witness protection. Yeah. And so those three things could be the proof that he needs to prove that he actually didn't do what he did.
Good concept.
Yeah.
That sounds like the sort of like three wishes genie clause where you can't wish for more wishes. It's like you can't ask for something that gets you out of witness protection.
I believe the FBI operates the genie clause. You have three wishes.
My first wish is infinite wishes. Damn it.
Again. Foiled again. Yeah. That would be interesting to.
And it's a great premise. He actually has a certain charisma to him as well.
I've been wondering about when he'd start, I saw John Hamm was in some film recently, and I was like, yeah, why doesn't John Hamm seem to, have that star charisma? So does.
But he doesn't.
Jamie from Game of Thrones.
Well, Hamm doesn't seem to want it. Hamm is one of those generation of character actors born in a leading man's body, which is a rare tragedy.
Yeah.
But same sort of James Franco for 10 years when he was bouncing around Hollywood doing stuff he clearly didn't want to do.
Yeah, because John Hamm was custom made to play older Superman, wasn't he?
He's basically Cary Grant.
He's
basically Cary Grant reincarnated. And it's he just wants to appear in BBC sitcoms. Leave him alone.
Put a cameo in Toast plan.
Yeah.
Do Superman 3.
Staying in Dublin, Bruce Campbell is coming to town.
Oh, I heard this.
So Bruce Campbell is coming to do a book signing and a Q&A in the IFI, and it sold out within about 15 minutes of the tickets going on sale.
And it seemed to come out of nowhere, the announcement.
Yeah.
There was a warning at 4:00. There was a warning at quarter to four.
Yeah.
Is he promoting a film or is it?
No, it's a new book.
Just book. Okay.
A sequel to If Chins Could Kill.
Yeah, called Hail to the Chin.
Yeah. Some reason, he's wearing a kilt.
Outside the castle in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
That's where, I can't explain it.
Sadly, he didn't call it If Chins Could Kilt.
That'll be a
god. Get him killed in Scotland if you tried that. Yeah, so that, I mean, who doesn't love the idea of Bruce Campbell? That's brilliant.
Yeah.
And elsewhere, over across in Golov Palace, the Picture Palace is opening at long last. After
it's really just sprung up, hasn't it?
Yeah, after 117 years.
I heard, actually, and it was something we talked about on the last episode I was on, anyway, was that they didn't have the capacity to show 35mm, but I've heard that
that's
changed.
That's not true.
Okay. Nope.
That's our podcast power in action. That's where it's moving.
Our campaign.
Got it wrong, it was never, they never said whether or not display a 35mm, but they did.
And
this week they said that it could.
And was that in response to a question?
Yes.
Okay.
They,
yeah, because no, I haven't seen any note on their website saying that they have these capabilities. People just don't advertise these things anymore.
They're selling. Like, when are they opening officially?
It's opening Friday. So
what's the first screen?
They've got I, Tonya, Lady Bird, and
Shape of Water.
Oh, okay, cool. So they're not doing like a retrospective. Right, they're just opening business as usual.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
So it's run by Element, who run the lighthouse, and they paid £1 million to get. To finish the building and to get a 30-year lease, of which they don't, which the first 25 years are tax-free or rent-free. So essentially,
it's really a five-year lease over 30 years.
That's really not a bad deal.
Yeah. So it was. And so Element will run it the same as they run the lighthouse here, and so
nice.
I think it's really good news for Galway because Element have done a really great job with the lighthouse, and especially after I moved to Galway. I think it was about 9 years ago, and was told that the cinema's going open soon. I was like, this is amazing. It's going to supplement my film education here so well. And now to actually see it opening, which I don't believe will happen until it really does at this point, I'm such a cynic. It's really good, and to have it in the same hands as the lighthouse is just really encouraging.
Yeah, so because it has been one of those gigantic boondoggles because it cost $8.4 million to actually build this place. It turns out that if you try to build anywhere near the docks in Galway, when you dig a hole, there's water.
Yeah.
I mean, who knew?
And there was a whole thing about a neighbour getting cross about a wall. Just every possible problem came up.
It seemed
neighbours should be excited about getting a cinema, not losing a wall.
I like that, you know, even though it is a cinema that's going to be showing top of the line films on a 35mm projector, it's still in rural Ireland. It's still about a wall. But it reminds me, was it In the Loop, where the Prime Minister has to deal with the boundary wall?
And then eventually, because
she no water with the hole, she's got a fucking water cannon.
I love that film.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that Britain are still trying to build a wall, so, you know.
Political humour. Yes.
No, but I mean,
am I correct in saying that will be the only 35mm projector outside Dublin at this point?
Does Triskel have one?
I don't know.
Mm, okay.
Yeah, Cork definitely doesn't have any. Galway.
Belltable?
Yeah, doesn't.
Limerick?
Not that I'm aware.
I don't know.
Maybe the future.
I don't think I need to.
There's a 35mm projector in my house, but that's that's still within Dublin. So.
Technically, it's still in Dublin.
It's Dublin 18, it is Dublin.
It's good to see one opening. Christ, when's the last time that happened? Who knows?
Why I'm surprised that there's not like a retrospective or anything like that.
Yeah,
like classic film.
Sort of
I mean, I would have thought, but even the Paul Thomas Anderson prints that we're doing recently.
The announcement was quite sudden. I think was it Monday they said we're opening Friday.
Yeah,
but that's because you don't want to jinx it.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's just get it open.
We'll have the party next.
First film started 5 minutes ago.
Yeah. We're open.
We are open. There
1 year
no
anniversary is the time for the big show off film. Yeah.
It's been a little bit in flux, and so there was talk that it was going to open this Friday about a month ago, but it was never confirmed. It was always sort of just rumors and speculation. So it is great. It will be open.
Really great.
And it'll be, of course, one of the bases for the FLA in July.
Good.
So can't wait for that.
And the 35mm will probably come handy for that, right?
Almost everything at the FLA is DCP.
So yes, not.
I might give them the chance to do some interesting retrospective.
Do a retrospective. Get someone to host it.
Speaking of the FLA, we have a new FLA programmer.
So Gar has stepped down after 8 years. Gar O'Brien. He is, and he is being replaced by Will Fitzgerald, who's been there for a number of years as well in various different capacities. He programmed the shorts at one point. He was a festival PR person, and he's worked in the industry with other festivals, and Irish Screen America and Tribeca and stuff. So he's a good guy. I find him very easy to deal with, so I'm quite happy that he is taking over at the class. And I'm looking forward to seeing, because the flat's currently still open for submissions. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to seeing what his first program is for the 30th
year. Yeah, what kind of changes that might bring.
30 years?
Yeah. Eight years is a long stint to have to follow up. So yeah. you wonder what he's thinking at the moment. Is he going to change it up a lot? Is he going to try to keep continuity? It'll be interesting to see.
Well, I think year one being the 30th anniversary, you might
be
a little bit more
traditional.
Yeah,
or grand,
a little more conservative in thinking, you know. Give him a full year then before he programs. Anyway, on to the top 10. At 10, it's The Post.
Still there.
It's still clinging on.
Yeah. 5 weeks.
There. It is. It's fine.
It's grand,
yes.
Yeah. It's perfectly solid mid-tier Spielberg.
Yeah.
And perfectly mid-tier Oscar bait. And perfectly mid-tier in general.
Yeah,
highly
mid-tier.
Yeah.
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 I mean, it is exactly what you expect. It is Tom Hanks plus Meryl Streep plus Spielberg plus an Oscar-worthy story, and it's a good film.
And
it's
well made, and made in a remarkably short period of time as well. Famously, while Ready Player One was rendering its special effects.
He's here in Ireland at the moment, Spielberg.
He is
an executive producer on a new film called The Turning, which is based on The Turning of the Screw, the 19th century Gothic horror.
From Floria Sigismondi.
Yeah, she's directing. So she directed The Runaways. She also did a couple of episodes of American Gods and stuff.
And
so
a couple of episodes of Daredevil as well, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, she's
the only good ones. The only ones that actually look like they were directed.
And she's a music video director as well. Has worked with like Bowie and Rihanna and a number
of. It's based on The Turning of the Screw.
Yes.
It's effectively an Innocence remake.
Yes, it is a little bit,
Ooh, that's a dangerous thing to be doing.
I do think you get kind of a grandfather clause, though, adapting
Turning
the Screw, but...
Yeah, it's 1890 something.
I feel like The Innocence is more a remake of Turning of the Screw.
Yeah, and they're filming at the moment in Kilruddery House in Bray. And there is all sorts of secrecy on that one. So, anyway, moving on to number 9, and nobody knows anything about this. They can't possibly know anything about this. Tad, The Lost Explorer and the Secret of King Midas.
Oh, I've seen posters! It's CGI,
animation.
Right? It's CGI that looks sort of like the kind you'd see on BBC, from what I've seen of it. It's like Top Cat. It's like those Top Cat movies.
Okay. Which are also... they're Mexican, aren't they?
Yeah,
those are Mexican because it was ridiculously popular in Mexico for some reason. So Mexican animation studios have just produced terrible Top Cat films.
They're really bad. As opposed to the classic Top Cat films.
Well, the TV show is inoffensive and funny.
The ads, you know, where Top Cat is
going
for a long time.
Yes, the Hanna-Barbera ads.
I don't want it.
Terrible. That's your nostalgia
Top
marketing.
Really cashed
Top Cat needs a mortgage for a new bin.
Everybody wants to see Fred and Wilma Flintstone filling out forms in triplicates.
Yeah, that's Halifax. If you want to blame race to Halifax.
But I mean, who thought that was a great marketing idea? Baby boomers like nostalgia, therefore let's have cartoon characters get mortgages.
Also, it's probably one of those canaries in a coal mine for when Top Cat can get a mortgage, you know, headed the wrong way again.
Officer Dibble,
your co-signer on this mortgage.
Anyway, so that's Spanish animation. That's
clearly have nothing to say about.
But no, none of us have seen.
You saw the poster though. What was that like?
Last week was midterm, so that was the end.
That's
of
where
the
that
of
bursts in.
Yep. So it came in one weekend and out the other. So essentially, it didn't make
that's
the
one
top,
turn of phrase.
It didn't make the top 10 in its first week. This is its second weekend. So you know, it's
got legs.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that it's
wasn't tied for last place.
It's made $150,000, you know. So I mean, it's done better than some
probably in profit.
Yes. Yeah.
At 8, and oh god, here, I wish this was animated. Father figures. Owen Wilson and Ed Helms.
Yes, and a bunch of actors who should know better.
Including Oscar winner
J.K. Simmons. And Glenn Close. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't get any notification that this was screening. I didn't. There's no.
Twitter sounds like a real, like a week with like the promoted ads. Yeah.
The poster is atrocious looking.
Because it's just bastard, right?
It's just
the word bastard. It's like sex. We got your attention.
Well,
yeah.
Well,
because
also,
they're searching for their father. So
yeah, better title, yeah. Bastards, rather than.
Yeah, that would have made it very hard to market. Ask the guys who
people
did
People go
along yeah.
looking for the Claire Dennis movie. And you're like, God damn it.
Maybe if we spell it with an E.
No, the other poster, not the one that swears at you. The one with the with
all the actors crammed together.
Crammed together.
But I mean, that would seem to be the appeal of the movie. It's like watch these actors slum it, and oh by the way, there's Ed Helm.
Yeah. Watch them debase themselves. Yeah, and your leads are Owen Wilson and Ed Helms. No, thanks. At 7. Three billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. Sorry, the BAFTA award-winning three billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. And
good
the
for
award-winning.
Good for it.
Good for it.
And preliminary Oscar favorite.
No, it's it can't be. Well, it was originally, but now it's out, surely, without a Best Director.
No, it's favorite.
What?
Wow, really?
Is it still favorite in
Bookie's? Bookie's favorite as of this moment, yes.
Okay, well, keep in mind that there are four different favorites depending on who you ask. It's a wide open race.
It's really
which
up and down this year.
It happens, which is kind of interesting to see.
Now and again, I remember Argo won Best Picture, and everyone was like, I guess it just
directed
itself.
It was one of only three in the entire history of the ceremony.
But I think
without a director nomination.
You know, it's important that now we're at the point of the 5 to 10 nominations and preferential ballot, which kind of throws all these, you know, basing stuff on stats up in the air a little bit, that you can't necessarily rely on those correlations that would have been hard and fast previously.
But it also lends to the middle of the road decent film that offends nobody.
Mm-hmm.
Winning.
No, absolutely
not.
Yeah.
So
there is a lot of kind of vitriol against Three Billboards.
So Three Billboards is out by that count.
Whereas
Lady
Bird has offended nobody.
Yeah.
Everyone likes it.
True.
But they don't even knock the champion, but they like it.
Yeah.
Perfectly grand.
Yeah, but the Oscars has that capacity now because of the preferential system.
Yeah.
Something
it's
else
not.
Can sneak in where everything, you know, two others are winning.
Aren't sort of pulling the votes,
something
like
else
the idea is to,
been.
The key is to, and again, I don't know how much attention you should pay to awards daily, but the key is to ask the second or third preferences of various voters and determine which films have alienated the voters for other films.
Because
there's no way Shape of Water people are going to vote for Three Billboards. There's no way Get Out people are going to vote for Three Billboards. And vice versa.
Yeah.
Everyone's voting Lady Bird somewhere.
And
they're at three and everyone's
I'm
still rooting for
a
Dunkirk.
That would be quite a surprise to see Lady Bird go up and take it.
Well, the Dark Star was 300-1, so if you want to take a punt, then
I absolutely do not want to take a punt. I would. I
really
but come on, that would make you feel better if it does happen.
I really wouldn't. I would be offended to win money after.
I was going
to
say it's like the people who bet on Trump.
Yeah,
exactly.
This is more to say.
But I mean,
or those that bet against their own team.
I just see that as like happiness insurance. It's like I'm sad, but
either
I have
way,
money.
I win. Yeah,
yeah, it's like, I'm sad, but I can buy ice cream now.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So, what do we think of the odds of that actually happening? Lady Bird sneaking in.
What are we talking about? I've seen like it's either Dunkirk or Lady Bird. Presuming then the other two maybe take each other out. Is that the?
Did they take each other out and
get out?
Get Out is in the
conversation.
Yeah,
get Out is in the conversation,
out,
and Dunkirk is apparently, according to the polls done by various American websites, they're saying Get Out and Dunkirk are the surprise ones to watch, the dark horses to watch.
Well,
because everybody's watching Shape of Water and Three Billboards.
Gold Derby is the gold standard for this sort of stuff. Shape of Water is 3-2. Three Billboards is 15-8. So they're almost identical.
Yeah.
Get Out is 7-1. Lady Bird is 18-1.
Mm-hmm.
Dunkirk's 50-1. Can't Bear Names 50-1. Phantom Thread 80. And the Post and the Dark Star 100-1.
Can we not just give it a Phantom Thread?
Stop all your fighting and just give it a Phantom Thread.
Just
like that's one approach to the Oscars.
Sorry, throw them all out and give us a number 5 on our list, The Greatest Showman.
With phenomenal success story.
Yeah, it's had an incredible life.
8.8 million in its opening weekend, crushed by Last Jedi on its second weekend, and this. It's now opening a sing-along version. Yeah. I don't
and you say that it opened at the same time as The Last
it opened
Jedi.
The
Last Jedi isn't showing anymore.
Yeah. It opened the week after The Last Jedi and got absolutely crushed. I think you did the maths now.
19-time multiplier is what it has, which is unprecedented.
Yeah, and in fairness, that's because it was crushed in its
also,
opening weekend.
Jumanji, which came out roughly the same time as well, has like a 13-time multiplier, which is also mental.
Yeah, but it is... It's an amazing success story.
Who run into people who are like, you gotta go check out
the show. A lot of teenage girls. So whenever I've gone to the cinema, I've always been, and it's every time I go to the cinema about once a week in Swords, and every time there's like crowds of young women and girls who are like very excited to go to The Greatest Showman.
That's great.
I'm fairly sure they're the same girls occasionally, but it's fantastic. Okay. Like, it's amazing to see that much enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And again, sing along version this weekend.
Yeah, top five. 8 weeks out.
Yeah.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah. And number one in the UK, and it's what, sixth week?
Yeah.
It's going to be a great showman too at this rate. Yeah.
Yeah.
How much more P.T. Barnum can you take?
They'll find
the
a
The animal
way.
Neglect years. So.
I skipped six. Early Man was at six.
Good for that. I still haven't seen that.
Right, Early Man opened in the US last week.
How badly did
against
it?
Black Panther.
Oh, no.
Whoever was in charge of that, this particular decision.
Okay. You can sort of imagine the logic that's going through. Yeah, I mean, sure, it's socially
different.
Yeah, it's socially it's trending on social media. I mean, they're never going to show up and go see it. It's not like it's going to be the fifth biggest opening weekend of all time.
Yeah, it's not like a Marvel film appeals to children. Let's open up our. Oh, wait a minute.
And Claymation as well,
Morons.
God. Anyway. Four, Shape of the Water.
Really like Shape of Water.
So did I,
It's an opening weekend.
Stacey, who's been in the podcast, described as Grinding Nemo, which is not an inaccurate description of the film.
Outstanding.
It's beautiful. Yeah. It's a beautifully shot, beautifully directed, beautifully acted film. Modern fairy tale.
I remember going in and sort of thinking, like, Guillermo del Toro, I actually think he's like more hit and miss than others. I think when he's great, he's fantastic.
Yeah.
But every now and again, you kind of do wonder, like, he is someone who does a lot of talking about his films before they're made. I remember the one he was talking about for years with Tom Cruise, like The Mountains one.
Oh, At the Mountains of Madness. Yes.
And
that's Lovecraft. Come on.
Tell me, I would love to see that. Giant penguins. Tom Cruise versus giant penguins in the Antarctic.
Exactly. It. I remember like following and sort of thinking, he does all this like talking projects, and for so long I was like, just focus on one. deliver it.
How long did he spend on The Hobbit? He must spend 6 or 7
another
years.
Another good example. Yeah.
Slightly less long than the film itself, wasn't it?
Cool. Well, he was only going to do 2. He wasn't going to do 3.
Yeah, because that would be obscene.
But yeah, and then you go into The Shape of Water and you just think, this is everything that you like about a Guillermo del Toro film, like done really well, fantastic cast.
It's got that wonderful sort of love letter to cinema thing where it's got like a homage to The Red Shoes. Just because.
Yeah.
It's like, no context for the rest of the film. It's like, nope, there are red shoes and they're on a pedestal. That's the movie we're making.
We're also making the Loving the Creature from the Black Lagoon
movie.
A tree, Coco.
Just
Why Darren Has No Soul.
Hey, I've seen Shape of Water like 4 times and I tear up at the same bit every moment. So don't give me none of that Darren's Got No Soul. It's mid-tier Pixar. It's grand.
It's a bit better than that.
I can't help you.
Neither can I.
It's a little better than Brave. It's not quite as good as Moana. It's better than Frozen. It's about as good as The Princess and the Frog.
Whoa. Mid-tier Pixar is the level of Princess and the Frog. Princess and the Frog is a masterpiece.
Princess and the Frog is
great. Princess and the Frog is such a good movie.
Princess and the Frog is amazing Disney, which is mid-tier Pixar.
The last...
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, here we go.
No. Amazing Disney is amazing Pixar. Amazing Disney.
Yeah.
Disney at the top of their game.
Yeah.
Is...
Okay. Lion King and
Aladdin and
Hunchback
and
Notre Dame
and
the Renaissance, stuff like that. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. And Prince of the Frog isn't quite that.
Princess and the Frog isn't quite that, but it's not fair.
No,
and the songs are brilliant.
I love that I really love that film. I bawl my eyes out anytime I watch that film. Yeah. The Fireflies.
Because I got friends on the other side.
I suppose I'm interested where low tier Pixar becomes mid tier. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. Well, I was sort of ranking these.
Brave is where low tier Pixar becomes
mid tier. No, Brave is argued as underrated. But
Brave
is
underrated. I've seen it a good bit.
I would argue that like the issue is like when you're ranking your top 10 Pixar, you put in the three Toy Story movies. You put in, you know, Wall-E, you put in Up, and that's your top five gone already. And then you can get another five.
Incredibles,
Monsters, Inc. You can get the next five pretty quickly. And before you know it, you're in, you know, 10 to 15, which is the middle of the table for a 19 studio film. And Coco is somewhere between 10 and 15 for me.
Yeah, okay.
It's better than all three Cars movies. It's better than Monster University. It's about as good as Finding Dory.
It's better than Finding Dory. It's better.
Finding Dory's great.
It's better than Finding Dory. I've seen Finding Dory a lot lately.
But Mommy likes the purple stone.
No, Finding Dory.
You are the bastard.
Finding Dory is grand. It's just, it's better than all three Cars, because anything is better than all three Cars.
We're sitting in Cars in ascending order right at the bottom of the list.
It's better than The Good Dinosaur, because that's...
Yes, what a disaster that was.
That one was great, yeah.
But I mean, it had such
it's
potential.
It's The Lion King!
Yeah.
How do you...
Mess up The Lion
it's
King.
It's a Lion King, but with dinosaurs. How do you mess that up?
Yeah.
How hard is that?
It's better than The Bug's Life.
Yes.
So, you know.
Yeah, so again, 10 to 15.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe 10 to 13.
Right,
I like that our big argument this week wasn't over Three Billboards. It was over Coco or die.
I really like Coco.
I like Coco too, it's grand.
Have a kid and then come back to me.
I'll work on that.
No, I think...
may not get that done by next
week. No, I think...
This is great. Now I can enjoy Coco.
No.
This is your assignment for the week. Have a kid and watch Coco.
No, but it does change your perspective on these sort of stories that are about family, that are about... And it does change your ranking of Pixar movies as well.
You have watched all the Toy Stories 50 times at this point.
I watched... Toy Story 3 and 2 yesterday, and the day before, and 2 days before that. I've seen Toy Story a lot. My son is it's his go-to one. I saw Monsters Inc. 5 times in the last 7 days.
In bits and pieces, though. Hopefully, not
I saw
all.
Quite a lot of it. at 2, 50 Shades Freed.
Has anyone seen it?
No.
No.
Apparently, you were saying UK critic screenings were over in France.
Well, UK there wasn't a UK critic screening, so they decamped to France to catch it.
That's a much better story, though. Is that like the critics had to go on like a romantic, sexy mission to France to go and see 50 Shades Freed?
That's it, though, is it? That's the three.
There was another book. I think.
Was there?
Yeah, written from the. The guy
is it was written from the other side. Yeah.
So have they made enough money to
Jamie Dornan
to
just
that?
Sitting there waiting for
well,
the
he's, I think Jamie Dornan is done.
Yes, Jamie Dornan wants
I'm
it.
Not surprised.
Yes.
They never seem very enthusiastic.
No.
Well, that's because all that ever happens is that they're asked to talk about them and people speculate about the fact that they're having an affair, which seems to be the only purpose of the gossip magazines is to speculate that they're having an affair. They seem not to be having an affair.
Niall Keen observer of Jamie Dornan.
Maybe they're brilliant actors.
The evidence that we have to date.
They're saving it just for the
It's all in the tank, baby.
I'm willing to give that to Jamie Dornan. I'm not willing to give that.
Hey, Dakota. I would argue Dakota Fanning's better than
Dakota Fanning is brilliant. Dakota Johnson, not so much.
Sorry, Dakota Johnson. Got my Dakotas mixed up. It's like North and South.
Yes, one of them has Mount Rushmore. The other doesn't, and that is the Fanning to Johnson one.
Harsh.
At one,
Black Panther.
Surprising nobody.
No.
The biggest movie of the year so far, 1.1 million. In its
fifth own. Biggest opening weekend worldwide ever, right? Or
fifth biggest opening weekend in the US. Wow. Yeah, biggest for a solo superhero. Second biggest for what's considered to be a non-sequel. Which I don't understand because it's a franchise.
Well, they're all like it's the 90s,
he was
the 80s,
the
90s.
Third Captain America. It's like
it's
somewhere you're gonna have to draw a little map.
He would be up for adapted screenplay.
Yeah,
that's not
it's not. Yeah, so I.
I like that we're considering this as a contender for adapted screenplay. I really liked it. I actually really, really liked
Wakanda
it.
Wakanda Forever, man.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And it's amazing to show that if you give an underserved audience something, they will embrace it. And it's amazing. Like, you've seen the footage on Twitter from around the world. Like, people in Ghana, the Ghanaian premiere of, like, Black Panther looks like something to behold.
Yeah.
It's astounding. And it is. And again, despite all the the disappointing amount of hatred that you've seen online, you saw those whole smear campaigns with people claiming they got beaten up. Or
all Panthers matter.
Yeah, the old Panther matter sign and all this sort of stuff. But yeah, amazing. It's a fantastic, joyful, sort of triumphant sort of pop cultural experience. Yeah. Film is great. I really like the film. It's not as good as Creed, but...
Yeah, I think I was thinking about it as well. I mean, you, going into a film that you're so excited for and you've heard so much about, and then it's particularly, as I saw it, with like a packed audience of people who were like hollering and stuff. That was all fantastic. But yeah, I think the only like criticisms you could ever say is that it sort of...
It doesn't go far enough.
A little, yeah.
Well, its villain is the hero.
Its villain is the hero. He's the one who has realised what the problem is. And, okay, he's a little bit
extreme,
OTT on that.
I mean, the film's politics are a mess in that, like, it's a story about this guy who, without getting too spoiler or too specific,
he's
it's
an
about...
isolationist.
But it's basically... it's,
a libertarian.
It's basically about how the bad guy is this guy who's been trained in, like, regime change by, like, the CIA and by the government. So that. But it's okay because we've got a heroic CIA agent played by Martin Freeman, who's right here, perfectly willing to help, and, you know...
He really felt shoehorned in. That was literally like just to give, you know, the white guys in the audience, like, by the way, guys, you know, we do have a white guy here.
We have two of them.
But it did lend...
The Tolkien white
guys. Yes, that was the best thing about it. That was a very good joke.
Yeah,
it was a great joke.
Well, I mean,
I read it. But sometimes it does come up.
Oh, I just got that joke. I thought it was a spelling mistake. Idiot. I saw it earlier on a thing and it was like, those morons have spelled it wrong.
But that's arguably my biggest problem with the film, is that it feels very much like so much of it is geared towards making white Americans feel comfortable with it, despite the fact that certain amounts of them will never be. So you have stuff like, you have the heroic CIA agent played by, you know, who's Everett Ross, who's played by Martin Freeman.
Is going into an African country and, you know, blowing stuff up. I remember thinking, you're meant to feel sympathetic for this guy?
He's heroic. He's a CIA agent. Yeah. He's got, you know, despite the fact he's just discovered this African continent, this African country that has all these resources that they could exploit, he's still a good guy at heart, who's completely wholesome and, you know, would never think of doing anything underhanded.
Yeah,
that's
not true. Come on, you can see the Clinton in his eye. You know he's
planning a rendition.
that's the sequel. His Ross Rising or whatever. But even stuff like the Kilgrave character, who is very much like, he's a caricature of what right-wing white Americans or Trump voters think that Black Lives Matter is, in that he's a militant, angry African man. Kilgrave is Daredevil and Jessica Jones.
No, the villain is fantastic.
No, he's fantastic.
Particularly Michael B. Jordan, like, really.
It's an amazing performance.
Yeah.
And the villain is fantastically well written. So.
Except for one thing. He teams up with the white South African.
Oh, yeah. Well, to be fair, it's not exactly subtle, the white South African, when he turns to the only other white guy in the movie and says, oh, don't worry, I'm a bit more your speed.
Yeah.
It's not exactly subtle what's going through the South African's head.
Yeah.
Yes, but it's just that you're like, would he really team up with the white South African if he's that militant in terms of...
Well, I mean, he also, does other stuff with the white South African as well, without getting too spoilery. That feels, you know, like a logical extension of that.
Well, yeah, no, that is true. But it's just, that bit didn't... Yeah. Just wore a little strange.
As I said, I think the only criticisms were sort of criticisms you could level at any other Marvel film.
Yeah.
It's like things like special effects are sometimes a little ropey, and sometimes the fights get a little bit cartoony.
Yeah.
But everything else about it, I was like, this is great.
The CGI suits. Can we stop with the CGI suits?
For we've come a long way from Blade 2.
Our Green Lantern. But,
the CGI suit was not the problem with Green Lantern.
It was a problem with Green Lantern, though.
No, like, yeah, Black Panther's amazing, and it's bold, and it's ambitious, and it's clever, and it's just got this energy and swagger that's, you know, almost impossible to resist.
Yeah,
and Suri is bloody brilliant.
She's really good.
Sneakers.
Shuri. Shuri.
I mean, the entire cast, to be honest. Like.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Lupita Nyong'o.
Hard to find
a
weak link or anything. They're all really, really good.
Angela Bassett.
She's underused, though, from Green Lantern, is it? But I don't argue that. Like, that's it's underused.
And now Marvel has saved two human torches.
Redeemed two, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
They've reignited, haven't they? Yeah.
But yeah, no, Angela Bassett is underused, but I mean,
yeah.
Somebody
There's
has
a lot
to.
Going
somebody
on
has
the film,
to.
Film,
I'm about to say,
lot,
like,
yeah.
Given the cast seems to be, like.
How annoyed are you if you're Samuel L. Jackson and you're the only one that
yeah.
you're not in?
But to be fair, I can see there being a problem with being, well, Mr. Jackson, we're making this movie with all the black actors. We kind of feel like we have to invite you into it.
But they could have written him in instead of Martin Freeman if they wanted.
Yeah.
You know, it's.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. It would have been much better.
It's a bit odd, you know, that
yeah.
that's this is the only one that he's not in. Or,
well,
he's
well
in
no, it's not the only
one. Yeah, but I mean,
the moment that his contract, he had a 9-film contract, and he's only got, what, one film left? Maybe two at a push? That's the issue, is that, like, because they blew their 9-film contract with Samuel L. Jackson early, where they were like, hey, appear
yeah.
in Iron Man. Hey, appear in Iron Man 2.
Yeah. Iron Man 2.
Hey, appear in Captain America.
As crucially derided as Iron Man 2 is, it did a lot of the building for that
yeah.
universe. It was a kind of necessary cog, because
it
was
the
one that put
oh.
Wakanda there. It put
yeah.
it on a map in
yeah.
Iron Man
yeah.
2. So,
oh, no, like, yeah.
It served a function.
Oh, yeah, no,
you never want to watch it again.
It's not very good, but.
Hey, Sam Rockwell's great.
He is good in that, but
he's better than he is in Three Billboards. Anyway, at least he's a more redeemable character.
Yeah, if only Three Billboards had actually redeemed him,
well,
that would
yes.
be a valid
yes.
criticism.
Yeah.
And we're back to this.
He's less morally bankrupt in Iron Man 2.
Okay, that's a fair point.
That's where I was going with that one. Yeah, I didn't say he was redeemed. I said he less redeemable. All
right.
Yeah.
I like that you make it sound like you go to the Sam Rockwell store and you're like, okay, well, we can give you Moon Sam Rockwell or Lawn Dog Sam Rockwell, but we're out of stock on the Three Billboards one at the moment.
Hitchhiker's Guide Sam Rockwell is where is my high water mark. Then I don't know, Black Panther does
yeah.
is it great? It's great. That's
yeah.
the thing. It's because you it had so much.
Writing on it.
Yeah. It's
yeah.
such a burden of expectation because it is meant to be genre defining or it is meant to be culturally relevant. And I mean.
But this is an event as
yeah.
much as it's a movie.
I think that's what they've been like. Marvel's real accomplishment here is turning this into an event and like the like getting the hype built
well,
for
let's,
it. So.
Let's not give them too much credit. It still took them, what, 10 years?
Oh, to get around to it.
To get around to it. Like,
no, but in fairness, in the, this is this is a cultural event. That, you know, it's something that
it's a moment.
Is bigger, yeah, is
yeah.
bigger than the film itself. It is
yeah.
what the Justice League should have been. The Justice League should have been a cultural event. It is Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman. It's all of them.
But
I
think the problem is Justice League like, came after so many other superheroes
yeah.
when really that should be right at
the
start.
Beginning.
That should have been the big watershed.
Your,
like,
your
oh
Christopher
God.
Reeve and Michael Keaton
yeah.
Batman movie.
Yeah, something like that.
But I'm saying that, yeah, but the DC's problems with their universes are manifold, but they... Marvel have such a tighter grip on it. They have such
for
a,
better and for worse.
Yeah, no, absolutely true. It is formulaic, but
yeah,
they know what they're doing. And yes, it took too long to get to Black Panther, and yes, it's taken far
Marvel.
Too long to get to Captain Marvel or any female-driven film. It's taken way too long to get there. But everything they're doing is for its particular purpose at the time they're doing it, with the exception of Ant-Man. but... Well, Ant-Man was meant to be kind of outlier one, and they
yeah.
brought it in much more.
yeah.
it
they didn't have the
be...
right stuff.
yeah. yeah,
but yeah, it's just and they're obviously, in this instance, they obviously trusted Coulter to know what he was doing.
Part of me also suspects they knew that if they messed with Coulter, it would be a disaster.
Yeah, they can't deal with the PR of another
yeah.
filmmaker sort of storming it.
Yeah. But not any other filmmaker, a filmmaker on this film in
yeah.
particular.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like Ava DuVernay said that she wouldn't direct it because she was worried
that.
About
yeah.
being sort
her
of
vision
like,
and,
her vision and
yeah.
having to compromise with the studio and stuff like that.
But that's fair given
yeah.
like the history,
their reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
also
Patty Jenkins, like,
and every film in the Marvel universe. I mean, even when they sort of like try and do
sort of take on a comedy or a take on a sci-fi film. Sometimes works, sometimes it doesn't, but they do look similar, and they are like...
Well, even this looks similar, because this is, yeah. You're talking about like the CGI issues. The CGI issues are because it's oversaturated.
Yes.
And CGI doesn't look as good when you have to put it in bright daylight scenes, which the climax of this movie is.
Well, one thing that
you sit in Africa, you kind of can't avoid brightness.
Yeah.
Okay.
One thing I actually didn't love was I got all excited when I heard that they were producing this big Kendrick Lamar Bap soundtrack, and I was like, this would be great. And then I went in and found that they'd actually just had some Swede doing the standard like Marvel sort of universe action music with the occasional...
Well, no, because he was doing the accompanying album. He wasn't doing...
Yeah, I realized that afterwards. The Weeknd song was only in the casino scene. Yeah. I was like, I thought this was going to be like a much more interesting soundtrack. Yeah. And that's, again, like another small, tiny little issue. That,
yeah.
Just that it tended to follow that Marvel formula of having a very particular... Very
feel.
Yeah, very formulaic beats in terms of soundtrack and things like that. But again, this is like not really criticisms. The film's great. And,
it is what the film is, I should say.
Yeah.
It's a Marvel film at the end of the day.
It's the first one in a while that I'm rushing to go back and see again, which I haven't. I've wanted to see, and I have seen the more recent ones again. And like Guardians, the first Guardians I went to see 10 times.
Yeah.
Second Guardian. Yeah, second Guardians I saw once.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know what you mean.
Second one's grand.
Yeah, but it's...
No, it's grand.
It didn't have me rushing back to... Whereas I'll go see Black Panther again tomorrow. Yeah. You know.
I did see Ragnarok quite a few times.
Did you guys go see...
Yeah, Ragnarok is the one that I've seen more than... I've seen 3 times now. Was, yeah.
Did you guys go to see it in 3D by any chance? I did not.
No.
I did not feel that I needed to go see it.
No, you don't. No, you don't need to see any film in 3D.
Okay.
I was surprised to see it. I thought 3D was done then. I thought they weren't doing it.
Well, Avatars are coming back.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's
like
4 Avatars.
1 through 10, yeah.
I can't wait for them to not make their money back.
You say that though, like as if every James Cameron project hasn't seemed like the man pushing a boulder up a hill, trying not to get crushed, only to stand astride the hill, smashing everything.
He has to run.
We're all going to be cynical, and we're all going to say, "Oh, million Avatar sequels. Who wants them?" And then they're going to come out, and we'll all be like looking around, like, "What?
Why are there people who have painted themselves blue in Temple Bar?"
Yeah,
I will go see the Avatar sequel to see what the hell an Avatar sequel looks like. But
imagine
that's
why
it's going to make it funny. Yeah. Everyone will be like, "What is this?"
Dances with Smurfs.
Yeah, it's curious that you have. Well, yeah, we live in a world where there's 4 more Avatars coming.
That's not the biggest problem with the world that we live in.
Yes, but it's the most immediate problem right now. Anyway, we move on to what's out this week. And this week's a big week in terms of the sort of Oscar fair. As we get,
got to cram them out the door before the ceremony.
We get our Saoirse in Lady Bird.
How do you pronounce that?
Saoirse.
How do you say it?
She pronounces Saoirse.
But she's wrong.
But far be it
from us.
She pronounces it Saoirse because, I mean, that's fine. But it comes from the Irish word Saoir, which is freedom. So Saoirse is how it should be. But, you know, anyway, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it always annoyed me when she was on the... She has that line she drummed about Saoirse, like inertia.
Saoirse,
and I was sitting there being like, no, it's Saoirse.
It's Saoirse.
Yeah. Yeah. Ryan Gosling.
The complexities of Irish pronunciation.
I don't mind. It's a nice conversation starter.
It is.
Oh yeah, no, it's grand. But anyway, the Roland bit's easy. We can pronounce that one. That one's fine.
That hurt me to do fine.
Yes.
As long as you don't start bringing fun.
And Lady Bird's good. I like Lady Bird.
Lady Bird is a lovely film.
I really like Lady Bird. It's one of my favourite of the Best Picture nominees in this current Oscar crop. I really, really enjoyed it. Laughed a lot. I think Saoirse Ronan is...
Oh yeah, and Laurie Metcalf as well.
Laurie Metcalf is absolutely phenomenal. It's just being robbed this season, although I haven't seen Itania in fairness.
The ensemble cast is amazing.
Yeah, Tracy Lance. There's nobody who doesn't do a great job.
Timothy Clement is in there again.
He's very, very funny. And Lucas Hedges, who gets quite a sort of strangely nuanced role that kind of doesn't go where you expect it to. I really like what Gerwig does with it because I think her writing can often be quite self-conscious, and this is sort of the first time she's gone off on her own, and she's really interesting. I think she's had some directorial experience and writing experience mostly in collaboration with men, and it's good to see that when she goes off by herself, she is
maybe free of their influence.
Or at least confident enough to tell.
It did feel very Bambricky, like Alan-y sort of.
Well, that's her sensibility.
Oh, no, I know.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, just, you know, in terms of being...
No,
but
in terms of the stuff that she's done with Bombeck,
it's not another Bombeck film.
It's not. There is a clear distinction there. Her voice comes through much more clearly, I think. Not that it didn't in Frances Ha.
It's quite personal, though, as
well.
I mean,
she
did have that Catholic school upbringing. So.
Yeah. And, you know, the charge is leveled against it by some people that it's really formulaic. But, yeah, it's a genre piece, essentially.
Yeah,
you know, it's the coming-of-age film, and it's got a very distinctive twist on it that, like, centres on female sexuality and things that we don't typically see in these films. And
that particular aspect of it, that experience of losing her virginity and that and all of that and the aftermath and the just sheer blaseness of the involved in that, I think that's important. I think it's important for
and there's such candor there that people aren't necessarily used to. Which is ridiculous.
The mother daughter relationship that when you're a teenager is
you love me, but do you like me?
It's got great lines like that. They're just like really cutting bits in there. I've seen it in the trailer so many times because it's been. You know, it's taken so long for it to actually come out that the trailer's been around in the cinema for ages.
We saw it in what, early December?
In early December. And again this week. I've seen these movies more before they come out than afterwards.
Yeah. That little look that Laurie Metcalf gives Saoirse Ronan when she says, you know, they have the whole conversation about being the best version of yourself. You know, what if this is the best version? She just gives her a sort of look. And they're amazing little bits like that. They're so much contained in a moment. I really like this film.
I was very on board with it from the very start when she chucks herself out of the car. I was like, yes, if this continues in this vein, I am in. And then it kind of mellows, and I was like,
I think it's grand. I think the two performances are amazing. I think it tells an interesting story. I just think that it is very familiar, and there's nothing wrong with that. We just spent 20 minutes talking about how Black Panther is great and familiar. This is great and familiar.
It is very much a American coming of age.
It's weird
film.
To be nostalgic for post 9/11 though. That struck
strange,
me as weird. There's a weird nostalgia for like 2002 in there.
It's the last point where we don't have smartphones.
That's
2007.
I always think that's really important for like teenage films that like from this point on.
Everyone will have to incorporate smartphones.
Genre teen film is going to be something that is not even perceptible to me.
There's a moment actually in Mom and Dad, that new Nick Cage film, where the daughter gets her phone confiscated in school, and it's just this little moment where it gets rid of in advance. The thing, why doesn't she call anybody?
Yeah.
And you're going to have that from now.
These
on.
Days you do.
That's why you're in the woods and there's no cell.
You have to have these little.
We have 99% coverage except for all the creepy woods.
Well, in fact, a lot of woods are in areas where land is sparse or is inarable, and so as a result.
Doesn't need service.
Yeah,
but you don't have to justify it now.
Anyway, Lady Bird, it's really good.
It's very good.
The other one, I, Tonya, which I think I prefer.
Is amazing. I, Tonya is amazing.
It is vicious.
It is so bitter and acerbic. It's fantastic. I absolutely love I, Tonya. I've seen it twice. And it is really bitter, really nasty, really twisted, really cynical. It's a biopic for the post-truth era. It's bent, it's curves, it overlaps itself. It's full of contradictory statements. It takes its characters entirely seriously and therefore takes itself entirely non-seriously as a result. It's just astounding. Robbie is fantastic. Jani is amazing. It is just this rich, vibrant. It's the story of Tonya Harding. In some ways, it plays as a prequel almost to American Crime Story season, looking at the O.J. Simpson trial. It's got that same American...
It actually
almost
leads into it at the end.
It actually there's a really nice bookending scene, but it has this sort of like American fascination with celebrity and sort of like the twin desire to idolize and to despise, and it works really well. It is maybe a little bit Scorsese-esque in places, and they very much play that up with the trailer. It's like the Goodfellas of figure skating, which is a fairly reasonable description of it. But it has this wonderful, like, even its obvious fakery, So, for example, the long takes that are constructed in such a way that they cannot possibly be real. They're manipulations of, like, digital photography and stuff like that. So characters appearing multiple times in the same long take. Or those shots of Margot Robbie's face superimposed on the stunt double doing the ice work.
Yeah.
All of that feels like it plays into the same idea of, like, fabrication, distortion, that really fits with what the film's doing. I absolutely adore it. It's one of my films of the year so far.
That's
but keep in mind, I loved Three Billboards, so take my opinion with a pinch of salt.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, because I didn't love it. Not that I completely hated it, but I just didn't connect for me in that same way. And it's interesting what you're talking about fabrication, because I think that was part of it. I felt like I couldn't help but watch. I thought Margot Robbie's great, but she's miscast. Like, she's an Australian supermodel playing a 15-year-old child.
Yeah, that's it. I love that bit where she plays
I mean,
the character at the age of 15 with braces
in. It felt like, you know that John C. Reilly film?
Yes, Walk Hard.
Walk Hard. It felt
yeah.
like that, where they sort of have John C. Reilly playing a 12-year-old kid, and
yeah.
it's a joke.
But I thought it was a joke here.
I think that's, for me, that just didn't land. I think there were a few moments like that where I just wasn't, like, on the same wavelength for the tone or something, and I found, like, one criticism I've been reading about it since, trying to reconcile my own opinion on it. But somebody was saying that it was like hillbilly porn, that it was sort of like the way it focuses on her poverty in a sort of very, like, look at this, an almost lurid way.
Yeah. But it also then points the finger at the audience very clearly and says, like, there's a moment where she literally turns to the camera and says, "You all abuse me."
Yeah.
Now, again, there's a question of how much validity you put in that given what you know about her. But the film, I think, at least gives her the courtesy of looking at it. Like, I mean, there's no... Bobby Cannavale pops up for no reason other than to play, like, the embodiment of this parasitic, exploitative media entity. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I feel like it's self-aware enough that it gets away with that stuff. But that's from...
No,
that's
I think that's the thing. And it turns on your interpretation of it. Either
yeah.
you think it's self-aware enough to get away with those kind of... Even those shots and the use of music and
yeah.
now we're doing this... And now we're showing you something horrible, but the characters are going to sort of, like, nearly do
blasé
it.
Blasé about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we'd be blasé about it. And it's actually funny, because I haven't made this connection, but I was just thinking there about The Wolf of Wall Street and Margot
yeah.
Robbie, and that similar kind of...
Frantic editing,
frantic
quick
editing,
moving, yeah.
You kind of... You're not really getting an impression of these people as real people. They're just more
yeah.
broadly drawn caricatures and
yeah.
yeah, that's a very interesting point, but yeah, I just did not love I, Tanya in the same way.
Yeah, no, I
did. Didn't hate it.
I'm with Darren. It is. I just love how dark it is.
It is really dark. It's
vicious.
It's really mean. It's a spectacularly mean piece of cinema, which is sometimes what you need. Apparently, I was surprised at how much I liked it, given how mean it was. But
Alison Janney is also very, very good.
She is a standard.
Scary good.
Oh yeah, but she always is though.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have absolutely no problem with this being a Lifetime Achievement Award Oscar. Similar to the J.K. Simmons thing with Whiplash. I mean, he was great in Whiplash as well, but
yeah.
it always seemed like a cumulative sort of thing.
Yeah.
I know. J.K. Simmons is great. No, he's,
yeah.
So.
My personal favorite thing was I was at a screening of Whiplash where it was introduced, and it was like, J.K. Simmons, as you've never seen him before. And I'm like, do you guys not watch
Oz?
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. Nobody here
don't
watch
see
Oz.
Places.
the Aryan Nazi, yeah.
You've
so
seen
think,
him in Spider-Man, yeah.
yeah. This makes his presence often.
Yeah, where he's also
yeah.
a bit of a bastard in Spider-Man as well.
yeah, but
yeah.
not quite on the same scale.
Not quite as bald.
Yeah.
and the last film out this week is one that I don't think any of us have seen. It's Finding Your Feet.
I've seen it.
Oh, have you?
It's perfectly okay for exactly what it is. It's a... Like
middle-aged
romantic comedy, yeah. It's very much a
oh,
bunch
this
of.
This is the one with the really strange cinema ads where Celia
yes,
Reyes
where
saying,
it's saying,
"Come see it in the cinema."
See
where...
it with a crowd,
yeah.
And it's like I saw it with a crowd of people who are significantly older than I am, and they enjoyed it more than I did. So maybe those ads
they
are
all
true.
Listen to the ad, yeah.
yeah.
Well,
but
there is a great need for films that serve it. So
oh yeah, no,
absolutely.
There absolutely is.
Seen Best Exotic Marigold
yeah.
Hotel,
yeah.
It's incredibly.
This is not as good as that. This is
or
no
Mamma Mia.
Yeah.
It's
oh, Mamma Mia.
But there is with
that's
Amanda
really
Seyfried.
Playing to your ballpark.
Yeah. yeah. but yeah, no, this is grand. It's like a rough outline of a romantic comedy where, like, it hits all the beats except somehow misses several of the key scenes along the way. There's like, you know, the character who is like this stuff sort of upper crust, sort of stuffy, like, you know, she's a lady by formal title, and she has to move in with her hippy-dippy sister, and then there's like Timothy Spall. I love that Timothy Spall is a romantic lead. This is the best thing
finally,
about the film.
Yeah.
Finally, Timothy Spall is a romantic lead. But he's like the gruffy, yeah, he's the gruffy, lives on a barge, fixer thing off guy, who she initially has
romantic
this sort of...
Lead.
Yeah, who has this
so
sort of...
The way he's waxing down the boat.
Yeah.
It's a Nicholas Sparks movie, like middle-aged British people.
Yeah. Shirtlessly waxing down the boat. But yeah, he...
with the dog.
Yeah. But there's a
in
moment
the
where, there's a moment where, for example, like she has this big epiphany that she absolutely has to have for this story to work.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God, I've been horrible to these people and I'm, you know, I'm not above them or whatever. But it happens entirely off screen. What happens is she walks into the room and they're like, oh, I see you changed your mind last scene. She's like, yes, I changed my mind about a lot of things. And that's all you get
okay.
for that character
arc.
A
budget cut.
Yeah, we have to cut most of the scenes where she actually changed her mind.
She died on the way back to his home planet.
But there are a lot of scenes like that to the point where, like, there's another scene where, because it's a romantic comedy, you have this third act, like, complication that has to get in the way of, like, of Imelda Staunton and Timothy Spall, you know, getting together like we really want them to. And that is also resolved off screen, which is kind of problematic given what it is. But yeah, it's like literally
a bold new take on the rom-com.
Yeah,
leaving the
actual like the actual. But it is though. It takes out all the conflict out of the rom-com, which is maybe what I think it's trying to do. But it does
or
end up with
you know
scene three.
That Simpsons said where they sort of like. They edit famous films
for
like
old
retirement
people.
Hopes, and it's the end of Gone with the Wind. But he's like, "I love you, and we'll get married again." And
yeah, it's
I think
like
that's what they're going for.
I think that's what they're going for because there's like, yeah, there's a moment where like one of the characters is like, "Oh, by the way, that big thing that kept us from getting together." That's gone. It should completely affect my character and change my outlook on life, but it's
Brexit's not happening.
Yeah, pretty much.
Brexit is definitely happening. These are middle-aged
Oh, yeah, that's true, actually, yeah.
But yeah, it's...
Great
yeah.
news, we're leaving New York.
It's perfectly okay as what it wants to be. It's not exceptional or impressive. I mean, you're looking at a week where you have Lady Bird and I, Tonya in cinemas. There is no excuse to go see Finding Your Feet. Maybe go see it at a matinee, maybe wait for it in Sky Movies if you feel the need.
Or screw that, or go see... The Hills of Eyes, the original in the lighthouse.
Oh, is it back?
In the lighthouse. No, Shut one night up. Only. Grindhouse. Oh. Yeah, Friday night.
Hello.
Yeah.
Nice. All over that.
Yeah.
Also, Mute is out this week, right? But we can't talk about that.
Mute is out on
but
Netflix.
We've been muted,
Netflix.
Yeah. We've been muted on that one.
That's Duncan Jones' new one that is not really screening for critics, which is kind of worrying.
I can neither confirm nor deny that.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a possibility that it may have screened for critics, but critics aren't allowed to talk about that.
Or make any reference to the fact that they've even seen it.
Which is
allegedly.
Which is, yeah, allegedly, so they say. Yeah, which is always reassuring when you hear that about a film.
I remember at the NDA Disney made me sign to get into like a Tron Legacy press screening, and I was what are they thinking? That's not good. Like, I'm not allowed to talk about it. A Cillian Murphy cameo? No one cares.
I do like it was a Skyfall had little letters that were like signed by the head of Sony saying, saying, please, our audiences, we want our audiences to experience it along with the film, so please don't spoil it in your review. It wasn't like a don't review it, it was just like a don't
so
mention
much.
That X character died.
Also, Skyfall is great.
Skyfall is great, yeah.
So,
I don't mind when they're sort of like, okay, just, you know, there's
use common
decency.
You know,
just be cool, guys. Just be cool.
Don't do that thing where people publish a recap and call it a review.
Mm, yeah.
Or the Peter Bradshaw. Don't do the Bradshaw.
Or the... Don't do the... That 2,000-word article breaking down every key scene from, like they did from Black Panther, the day of release.
Yeah.
Conveying the reasons why you like a film.
Everything about the film, yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, on that note, we'll leave it there for the week. Thanks very much, lads.
I'll never forget the first moment when I walked in Cure Cinema. I was hooked from there on. Huh?